Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we hear from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. In this very special episode of the programme, we're once again gathering Nobel perspectives from some of those brilliant laureates in economic sciences with whom UBS works to shine a light on the complexities and challenges of our fast-changing world. Back in 2017, UBS took the Nobel Perspectives Initiative to the next level with a two-day event in Singapore, marking the beginning of what's now a regular event series called Nobel Perspectives Live. Following events in Singapore, Shanghai, New York and London, in September 2019, Nobel Perspectives Live stopped in Hong Kong for the first time. UBS invited clients, employees and students to learn from and interact with Nobel economists Bengt Holmström, Robert Merton and Michael Spence. At the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, the three laureates took the stage, accompanied by Donna Kwok, APAC COO Strategy Lead for UBS Asset Management. In the audience, 500 students from local universities, eager to learn more about the two topics of the evening: sustainable growth for emerging economies and the future of the millennial generation in a fast-paced world. The first question of the two-hour panel was directed towards emerging economies. Here's Donna.
We've seen the need for the world to edge towards more sustainable, environmentally sustainable growths. So a lot of developing countries are being pushed to move away from unsustainable methods, but they still need to grow. What role can developed economies play in encouraging sustainable growth for their still developing peers? Professor Sense, yeah.
The kind of major existential challenge that we face. There was a time when people got it and they thought the only way to deal with this is to stop the growth. And what that really meant was stop the emerging economy growth. And that's not going to work as the solution. So we have to find another way. And that basically means reducing the energy intensity and the carbon intensity of the energy mix over time. The big opportunity in the emerging economies is much of the infrastructure, transportation, physical structures, and their energy efficiency are going to be constructed at this crucial period of time. And the urgency is not to do it right away, it's to do it properly. If you're going to have 3 billion people become urban residents in the next 3 decades, you're basically going to build their cities for them. And what I think is starting to happen, and it's a very good sign, is the world is coming together and saying, what can we all do to help countries help themselves? A whole lot of things that are going to be necessary if we're going to succeed. Now, having said that, so far we're losing. The carbon dioxide output of the global economy is now 37 gigatons per year. So we're about 2.5 times. What the scientists and the UN says is a sustainable level. And it's going up. Basically, we haven't rounded the corner yet. We haven't stopped the process of increasing global carbon dioxide emissions, let alone started to bring it down fast enough. So we may get there, but it's
tough.
A little nerve-wracking, I guess is the way I would say.
Yeah. We need everyone to grow in a more sustainable manner. I think it's very hard to get everyone on board if we don't have a few countries that put their hands up first and stick to what they promise.
The developed countries caused the problem, tick, correct. Therefore, they have to solve it. The problem with that is that that's impossible. Mm. Part of the challenge has been to get people's minds around the arithmetic. The long-run target for the advanced economies was 80% reduction. And the rule of thumb for the developing countries was 20%. Well, the problem with that was that that was too little. We've made two important transitions. One, the emerging economies of the world have accepted that even though it's our fault, meaning the advanced countries, we can't solve the problem without their engagement. So we crossed that bridge. And second, we've made substantial progress in deciding burden sharing.
What's your general sense of the awareness of sustainability issues, environmental protection? And what economic policies could be introduced to encourage corporations and people here to do more to protect the environment?
The awareness is fairly high and rising. There are critics everywhere. You know, we're not making enough progress. We're not paying it, you know, We're dragging our feet and stuff. Maybe 10 years ago, the countries that were preoccupied with growth were a little bit standoffish about this issue, right? I'll give you an example. Coal is a huge problem. It's by far the dirtiest fossil fuel, but it's also the cheapest fuel and the most accessible one, especially in India. Can they make this economy grow at rates that meet the hopes and aspirations of their people and yet try to do it without a massive increase in the consumption of coal? It's indicative of the kind of choices that are getting made. I think 10 years ago, Indian politicians representing their people would have said, now we're going to burn the coal. You know, we'll get around to the global agenda and stuff later. That's no longer the answer.
I'm going to take a question from the floor. Are you worried that robots will take over human jobs in the future, Professor Merton?
Skill sets for a number of people who are working are such that they're not going to match up to what's needed, and there will be job displacements. That's real and very important how we address it. Robots also create jobs that didn't exist. They create things that will actually enhance the job opportunities. I've lived through an incredible amount of technological improvements. I used to do everything for hand. I had to open a handbook, look up the functional value in a long line of tables, and if I was lucky, I had a calculator. Well, I don't do it that way anymore. But you know what? Whether it's email or those calculators, I find I work right up to the margin every day. I don't find that I have a lot of time off. Those of you who have lived through this transition, do you suddenly find you have a whole bunch of free time because now you have all this efficiency? Ask yourself, why not? You've adapted, and what you've used that technology for is not to get free time from working, but to be able to do so much more, increase your productivity, and if you're lucky enough to like what you do, that's fun.
I think everybody in Asia is well aware that the early stage developing countries, the ones that haven't reached the middle income transition, have found their comparative advantage in the area of labor intensive process oriented manufacturing and assembly. There are a bunch of countries in this category, and if the Asian growth model doesn't work, there's a kind of open question about what is the way they will connect and leverage global economy demand to enable their growth. A developing country cannot grow at the kinds of speeds that you've seen in Asia. There is a big change and potential threat coming from digital technology in that world. It's a dimension of this multidimensional set of opportunities and challenges that we have in the digital area. As Bob says, we're going to have to be smart and alert about navigating these things.
Professor Holstrom.
One of the things that will be very influential in how fast we are going to advance in this direction is how are we able to organize ourselves so that and adapt our organizations to this new technology. We have fairly old technology. Organizations are still very hierarchical, and we are putting this high-tech thing into very old structures. So I think that's going to be a key factor in how much we will grow and how we will feel about growth, making work meaningful to a large set of people and also, frankly, to tackle the income inequality that right now is growing because of the technology, but maybe leveling off in some ways. Historically, if one looks at it, the sort of real kick comes in when you realize how to create new kinds of organizations on top of some technological advance. And so we see actually some new forms of more decentralized organizations within firms. There's nothing very hierarchical about it. So that's an example of a structure that has developed with the help of the new technology. For me, as an organization economist, it's a very exciting thing to study.
Absolutely.
Well, innovation often includes a risk for companies. We've seen a few risk-taking companies in that regard, but not that many. Companies even fail to see the added value of innovation. How can we make sure companies dare to innovate?
A successful innovation inevitably runs way ahead of the infrastructure that's needed to support it. If you want to understand what I mean, suppose you built a train that would go 300 kilometers an hour. Well, the infrastructure is the track. If you don't upgrade the track and you run this thing at 300 kilometers an hour, it's a disaster. You don't want to say never go faster than the track because never you'll ever get the benefit of the innovation. I think we need to build an infrastructural way of encouraging innovation, allowing innovation to go, but also making sure that it proceeds in a way which is going to be most effective.
I completely agree with that. I think if I try to think of the ingredients that I've seen, the venture capital in the United States benefited from very favorable tax treatment.
Yeah.
So that was one. Second, there seem to be very big differences across countries and cultures in terms of the attitudes toward failure. Failure is inherent in experimenting, which is where innovation comes from. There's no such thing as real innovation in a totally safe environment. In Silicon Valley, where both Bengt and I have lived for part of our careers, one of the important drivers of innovation is that failure is actually valued. If you talk to the experienced venture capitalists, they'll tell you they'd far rather have an entrepreneur that tried and failed for the right reason, learned a lot along the way, increases the chances of success later on. If you have a system that punishes failure, I don't know. If you want to be an entrepreneur and you live in that kind of environment, my advice is move to a different environment.
Yeah. What suggestions or tips do you have for young graduates in terms of ensuring that their career progresses, but still maintaining some kind of a sanity in a work-life balance?
Rather than just thinking about learning the technology, I think it's about an attitude of learning, which hasn't changed, I think, in hundreds of years or thousands of years. You need, in my view, you need curiosity. Curiosity is a wonderful thing. You need to ask questions. The other part is that you have to have serendipity. You have to have luck, but you have to also understand how to make something out of the luck you have. You have to sort of get on to your journey and be prepared to take routes that show up on the journey. And it is that attitude, I think, that is really critical for where you end up. We are all started from different places. We didn't start with economics, but I think we all share at least some of that serendipity.
Professor Merton.
I endorse what you said. That's critical. Think of it in terms of two extremes. One extreme is the world never changes, which is, of course, not true. Then you can learn a skill to do something that you are good at, and that will last you forever. You're done. Everything we've talked about is the opposite. So that's not a good model to prepare yourself for the future. You don't know where things are going to be, and no one does. Global warming, climate, how are we ever going to solve this problem? Yeah. Well, people come up with ideas and technologies that we didn't know, and suddenly you're able to address it. And that's the wonderful possibility. Change is what there. So prepare yourself when opportunity knocks. Learn principles. It's the foundations of thinking. Principles of chemistry, principles of economics, whatever. Those don't change very much. Adam Smith is still a good read for that, even though the technology since Adam Smith was out of the realm of any possible dream. If you train yourself this way, you're going to say, come on, change. Come on, robots. Come on, new ideas that no one ever thought of before. I'm ready for it. In fact, because I'm ready for it, I am going to flourish in an environment of change rather than be fearful.
Yeah, well said, Professor. Agreed, agreed.
And that's Donna Kwok thanking the brilliant panel of laureates in Hong Kong, Bengt Holmstrom, Robert Merton and Michael Spence. This has been another Nobel Perspectives edition of the Bulletin with UBS here on Monocle 24. To read more from and about the laureates and to discover how Nobel Perspectives shape the UBS worldview, head to ubs.com/Nobel. Keep an eye and an ear on this programme in the weeks ahead as we enjoy more access to the brilliant insights of the laureates. We've more specials and documentaries in store. But if that's just too long to wait, Dip into a mix of videos and articles right now at the UBS Nobel Hub. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.